I'm interviewing Afifa Saeed, Senior Culture and Development Advisor for Asia and the Middle East Bureaus of the U.S. Agency for International Development. Thanks for being willing to talk with us about the work you do in culture and development at USAID. First off, could you tell us a little bit more about your background, your role at USAID, and what you're hoping to accomplish?
Sure. Very happy to be here, Susan. My background is in anthropology, with a focus on culture, identity, and then I was really very intrigued with development early on and how development and culture intersect. So that my academic background is in cultural anthropology with a focus on grassroots development, how communities themselves respond to and create their own opportunities for development. And a lot of my work from my academic and on has been on issues of identity within the context of various different realms, whether it's education, even the American experience of various identities and creation of identity. And I think what's really been interesting for me as an anthropologist is to understand that it's not just the study of the other. It's always going to be also the study of ourselves and how we approach what we do. So at USAID, what my hope is, and it's what it's being really, what's interesting about it is that I'm finding that so many people have the same intention, which is to change or to understand more how we as U.S. agency, government agency, interact with one another, how we interact with these issues, how we internally understand what culture means in general, but then how the culture of what we do affects what we do. Mm-hmm. So that's the big question. But then what do we do in terms of building the capacity to understand the places and the people we work with and work for? That's really what it comes down to. So building capacity, understanding what the tools may be out there and what tools we need to develop further in order to create that competency. And also, how do we engage? How do we engage with the communities we serve and those that we serve with is also important. So it's not just understanding the culture, but then how do you take that step further? In all, it's an internal and an external exercise, and I'm excited to say that my position and other positions and other efforts within the agency have come from really the grassroots, from the field. More and more missions and field offices were saying, we're living and we're working in a very dynamic settings, ever more dynamic, so we need to understand them better. So it's exciting to be able to say that came from there, from the field and from the people that are working in it, not just from a top down. What's been exciting, though, in addition to that, is that once that came from the field and our front offices at USAID responded by trying to have more of this expertise, and now we've got an administration that is even more interested but also mandating that we do development, but we do whatever we work in USG, do it with a more nuanced understanding and a competency that will help us have engagement that is more meaningful, is more relevant, in the end is more helpful all around. So it's a great time and place to be with something happening on both ends. And again, it's not just at USAID, it's across the agencies that we work with.
Well, one of the things that occurred to me when you were speaking that I just want to underline before we go on, and that many people may not give a lot of thought to, is not only is this international culture an issue, but you've got intra-U.S. cultures to negotiate, and even cultural differences amongst agencies about how people approach issues. There's been a lot of good work done in the past, but then how are we going to respond here in the U.S. and change our practice, change our policy in relationship to what we do abroad? And that's also a cultural challenge, isn't it?
It is. And I think what's really significant about that observation is that it's nice to be able to say, you know, we would like to do it and we're doing it. But then the important piece is institutionalizing what we say needs to be done. So we're having really great conversations internally, I think, within the agencies about shifts in frame and how we look at things, whether it's programming, whether it's strategy, whether it's even interagency engagement, which is really interesting. being at the table with all the different agencies working on a project together, working on an initiative that the president sees as important and mandates that we all work together on it. So it is, and it's not something that somebody has a manual for that says, here's the rules of engagement. Mm-hmm. We've got to try to figure it out on our own. And that's really, that's sometimes that's the best way, you know, to learn, but it's also the best way to understand what the challenges we face are because we're living it. So again, it's a great time to know that there is a momentum to do this mm-hmm. and as an interest to do this, but now we're trying to institutionalize it. How do we make it work so that it's not just a one-off? You mentioned about how we have done this in the past, and for USAID especially, we had a cadre of anthropologists in the 70s late 70s. We had folks that would be doing social impact analyses, which were great, but again, it was not something institutionalized to the extent that it was sustainable. And whenever we talk about anthropology now at USAID and these visions of more engaged involvement and development, folks say, well, we did have this, and people are doing this. But again, throughout the agencies, it could be a one-off, mm-hmm. or it could be dependent on some person's individual understanding or desire to do it. Mm-hmm. So what we're trying to do is consolidate that and create a better impact by saying, you know, for example, when we're doing programming in religious contexts, now we've created the momentum for it, but now we have a training that we do at USAID specifically for that, which is programming in religious contexts for the development and conflict context that we have. So it's not just talking about it. It's really trying to figure out how to do it. So one piece of it is how we interact with one another within the agency and then interagency, and then how that translates into how we work within with the field, the context of the field and outside.
Knowing how anthropology as a field has changed since the 70s, I would imagine that one of the ways to give some specificity to how you change the frame, the point that you made about grassroots development and looking at how the dynamics of a particular culture are being generated at the grassroots and being able mm-hmm. to understand that as an aspect of cultural analysis. Mm-hmm. In the 70s, it was more, more uniform lens that mm-hmm. cultural anthropology applied to the field. Is that your experience of the change of the frame? Just to give us a little bit more fleshing out of the changing of the frame.
Well, and you're right. It's a dynamic process altogether. Whether it's the discipline itself mm-hmm. and the field of anthropology, which is in its essence is responsive. It should really be changing with the times, if you want to say. But it's also responsive to the extent that it is a study of cultures, which in and of themselves are dynamic. So the piece that I'm really interested in the work that I do is this intersection between culture and development. Sometimes we have them as mutually exclusive, or we talk about how, well, there's culture and then there's development. But in fact, you know, from an anthropological perspective, I would say they can't be mutually exclusive because they're in tandem. They actually encompass one another. And ideally, when you think about development, you have to think about the culture of development or the cultures that are being interacted with in terms of development. And then culture itself, like I said, it's dynamic, it's changing, and the even the identities of folks that are within a culture are changing and are in fluid motion. And it's not something to say that we have to preserve a culture necessarily. And that used to be one of the issues that we had in anthropology, folks who say, well, all you want to do is preserve something and not help them develop or change or so on and so forth. But really the essence of culture is that in and of itself, people themselves are defining who they are, what their culture is, what their identity is. So as an anthropologist working in development, I have to acknowledge, understand, and appreciate that fact. So I'm not going to go in and label what this culture is or isn't. And I'm also not going to go and say, well, this group is this is part of this identity or that identity. I have to ask the question, who are you and how do you yourself identify and with what? And that is going to lead to a conversation about development very naturally, because what is development if not, helping the community understand where it is on its own and where it wants to be? And cultures have that already inherent in them. We know who we are. We know what we aspire to be, and we also know, as a matter of fact, what our challenges and what our drawbacks are to get to those aspirations. So what I would, you know, what we're trying to do, have this internal conversation, is when you go into a community, it's not a blank slate in terms of development. There's already stuff happening in so many different levels and manifestations. So the question really is, what is happening right in your community, and where are the gaps? And if there are gaps, would you, as an international donor or other agency coming in, would you want us to be there to help you to fill those gaps?
Yeah.
So that's the kind of script we're looking at that would finally come to development that makes sense, is meaningful, and is sustainable. And that is bringing the anthropology, but it's also just understanding what development essentially is. And even just this notion of definition. I've had some really interesting conversations with people about, what does development mean? And this is an internal conversation as well as external, because you'll ask people that have their degrees in development, define it. What does it mean? And everybody has a little bit of a different definition. And some of them have a canned definition, which can really get them stuck. But then when you go out into the field and you ask people that are living, what does it mean to you? It's going to mean very different things to folks. So that is another essential issue, is when we go into a community or work with a community, where are they and where do they want to be and how do they define that? And then go back and bring that to, well, what is our strategy for this country or for this community that makes sense?
It's extremely interesting. I know when I talk to people about culture, it's difficult for people to understand culture as a concept, let alone development. It's sometimes, say, it's like a fish noticing water, because culture is such a natural part of the way people organize their lives, and it's assumed to be natural, and natural should be seen as in quotation marks there. But when we work cross-culturally, being able to see the differences, that's not so hard, but able to see what differences matter, which are the significant signals that people are sending, and as you are, you know, saying in terms of the way you're approaching issues now in terms of grassroots development, how are people already generating their own power for change, which is development, and where are the places where we can form alliances, where are the places where some additional expertise could really move things forward, and how do we, as people on the ground, but also people administering these programs, how do we sort this out? Because cultural analysis is also being able to see the differences, but then being able to read how people are sending signals of what they prioritize and what they don't, and where the problem areas are, because sometimes those signals are not sent in at all the same way as they would be in your own indigenous culture.
Right, and just that multifaceted, you know, observation in itself reflects what we're working with on the ground, which is this dynamic, multidimensional thing we call culture. And so I think, you know, in the context of development, what we really are looking at is not just what is the definition of culture, or is it cultural sensitivity, which is just really, you know, being sensitive, meaning that you understand that there are differences. It's really much deeper than that. And it is understanding the geopolitical, it's understanding the historical, it's understanding how the people that we are looking at in and of themselves are not homogeneous either. You know, you walk into a village thinking, well, they're all going to be X or Z. And in fact, you know, they're not. There are lots more sub-X's and Z's to that identity. So I think that's, you know, that's the kind of the nuance and the texture we're trying to get to, is we can use culture in a very encompassing way. But what we're really talking about is, before you go in and create a strategy for a country or for a community, understand where the geopolitics plays a role. Understand where the issue of identity has crossed or not crossed over time and over space. And then have those conversations, and let those conversations be real conversations. One of the things that we're concerned about is imposed development, right? And this is what we've been talking about, is coming in with an agenda or coming in with a global program and plopping it down and saying, well, it's worked there, it's got to work here. And we do that, for example, with youth strategies. We think, you know, youth are universally this, that, or the other. And, of course, some of that is very true, and we have universal ideals and values and experiences. But let's talk to the youth and find out, how do they identify themselves? And is, for example, I had this great conversation in Mindanao where these young people were telling me, we're tired of leadership training. We don't want to be leaders. Why are we always being continuously chosen to, first of all, to go to, and these are the folks that are going to same trainings over and over because they happen to be on somebody's list. But they were, and I asked them, well, what would you rather be doing? And that was a question that hadn't been asked of them directly, because it was considered, well, they're youth, so of course they need this, which is in all good-intentioned programming. But in that context, there's something else. And just like for women, for example, I heard the same thing when I was in Afghanistan, which was that we do entrepreneurship training or business training. And some of the women were saying, we don't want to be entrepreneurs. We'd rather have a regular job. We don't want to have the hassle or the headache of creating a business. Although, you know, from our American context or culture or understanding, it's a great thing to be able to have an idea and go with it and spend the effort and the time and so on. So we help them to and guide them through that process. And even though they are beneficiaries of that and they're excited, it's not that they are rejecting it. But at the same time, they're saying, but there's another need that we have or another desire. Or I heard some, some other women's group say, we don't want to do chicken farming anymore. That's not something we'd like to do. So the question really becomes, you know, is it feasible to really take the time and the effort and collect, if nothing else, but data from the field? What are people thinking? What are people saying? What are people? And so it's not just having those conversations, but one of the things that we lack in development generally across the board is this type of information. We're on such a cycle of getting things out and getting things done all the way across the board, whether it's, you know, small NGO trying to do the work or a large donor, that we don't take the time or we don't have the time to spend to really understand what the needs are before we already decide what they are from some other very significant and very credible sources. But it's that extra time that we need to build in. And I think creating that space is something that everybody wants. And from my experience and my conversations across the board, nobody's saying we don't want to spend more time doing that. We're just trying to figure out how can we do it? How does it make sense? And where can we get it from? So ultimately, that what we do makes more sense. Everybody wants that, and I think that's the interesting part.
It is. Well, you include the Middle East in your portfolio, and you mentioned Afghanistan. We've got a military effort. We've also got a development surge. Just expanding on what you said about Afghanistan, what are some of the other cultural issues that you see are particular to Afghanistan or that right now people need to pay attention to?
Well, as you well know, and we know from history, Afghanistan has always been a crossroads for so much, whether it's been trade, it's been exploration, it's been all
Silk
sorts
Road.
Of... Exactly. And just going there, it's a living memory of that in many ways. You've got people that have migrated from Central Asia, you've got, you know, people coming in from the South Asia region and so on and so forth. So it's a very blended and mixed group of people, but also peoples and identities. And that's something that when we talk about the Afghan or the Afghanistan culture and so on, we've got to make sure that we pull back and say that we're not talking about one culture. We're talking about a dynamic that is has been historically multifaceted. And the usual stereotype that I, you know, we always hear is, well, they're also a very proud people and very staunchly protective of their identity, which is also true. You know, it's a very tribal area. I know that, you know, when we were there, the kinds of conversations we had with folks on the ground were things like, well, we are so different in so many ways as Afghans that having us just pull us together, pull all these tribes together, is creating the tension and the conflict. So that was one side of the story, which was just let us be the tribes we are and you won't see as much conflict. And then the other side of it was we are Afghan and that identity meant something. And that meant that we are very different from one another. So it was a really interesting dynamic. And of course, the idea of religion plays a big part in their identity, because as many of them will remind me over and over, we are the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. But then again, it's trying to pull out what does that Islamic piece mean as well, because a religious identity there is also very multifaceted and diverse. We're talking about Sunni, we're talking about Shia, we're talking about even the Afghan interpretation of Sharia within those tribes and within those regions. So, you know, it's nice to be able to say we can understand the Afghan culture and then move forward, but then understanding that there's so much more to it and there's so much going on, I think is going to help us to understand the nuances, and also not that the homogeneity is not there. So you've got the tribal, you've got provincial, you've got the religious identities. And then what struck me when I was there was also within that, I mean, you've got former Mujahideen who fought against the Soviet occupation, who have a sense of accomplishment, and they also have a sense of I'm not sure how from their perspective, but others will say that they are to be treated in a certain way. They're treated with some reverence because of what they did, obviously. In many cases, if they say something, it goes, just because of the fact of, you know, what they did. On the other side of that, you've got folks that fled and went to either Iran or to Pakistan and are considered migrants. And they grew up somewhere else. And in fact, a whole generation grew up somewhere else. And so you've got Afghans that came back and that speak Urdu fluently because they identify with the Pakistani language and some parts of the culture, although they were in camps and they were separate. But they have that mixture into their identities. They came back. And then a couple of things that I thought were really interesting when I talked to the young people in Afghanistan was some of them are relearning things that their parents didn't have the chance to learn as Afghans because they were gone or because it was a time of conflict. And simple things, I don't know, maybe it's not too simple, but things like irrigation systems. I was talking to somebody in agriculture who was saying that they've had traditional irrigation systems for centuries, I mean, for a long time, that always worked. But suddenly you had a generation that wasn't able to learn or to engage in it because of the war or because they had left. And so you've got a gap. So when we're talking to people about their orchards and about their fields and how they're not able to sustain them, they're trying to figure out how to do it. Or even simple things, the young girls were telling me, canning or preserving. Things that had been passed down from generation to generation, there's a gap. And, of course, that's going to translate further into how do you maintain a lifestyle that has been traditional for so long, and yet now you have a gap in it and you don't have anything to fill it. So then you have a sense of disconnect, but then you have practically, you don't know how to do these things. So then you're either looking for new ways to do it, which is frustrating because it is a new way, but it's also, so it's just that kind of depth to the culture, but also the dynamics that played into creating these identities, I think is fascinating, but not just for an academic reason. That helps us to understand when we do programming or we do strategy, where to start from. And that obviously we can't think of this as a, you know, homogenous group of people, but also as people that will respond to a program just because it's worked somewhere else.
Helpful. Well, going on with the questions about Afghanistan, for many Americans, the situation of women and girls in Afghanistan has been a focus for many NGOs and not-for-profit groups. And yet, over time, since the fall of the Taliban, women's situation in Afghanistan seems to have deteriorated rather than improved. And yet, women are such a central part of culture. They are the center of the family. Cultures around the world, they may do it in different ways, but they are very concerned about the role of women and the role of women in childbearing, child rearing. You can't be a society unless these critical functions are done. But yet, sometimes that role in the family is also, pardon me, makes it even more difficult to work on programs with women and girls. So it's we're talking about complications. It's a further complication. You've mentioned Islam. You've mentioned Islamic law. What are you trying to do in terms of development with women and girls, aimed primarily at women and girls in Afghanistan, though many programs may benefit them that are not specifically directed at them? But what are you seeing today, and what are you trying to accomplish?
Well, I think in general we have to understand and just to state the obvious, but to remind ourselves that women are always used as a symbol for what's happening one way or the other. And I remember some conversations I had with older Afghan women who said, you know, here we are in burqa, but not so long ago we were in miniskirts, and that was imposed on us by the Soviets. So when they had the occupation to show modernity, they were forced to wear miniskirts, which was not something they necessarily all wanted to do, which was not something necessarily they felt reflected, obviously, their tradition, but also what they were aspiring to. And here they've come, you know, to some of them they've come to the other extent, which is, again, representing where we're at by physically putting us in a dress or in a way that shows who the power structures be. So that's something that's also very interesting, is how women are used in symbols. I think what we're also concerned about, and this is an ongoing conversation, I think it's not, you know, a program or an approach, but it's also the terminology that we're using. How are we talking about what we do when we work with women? And I'll just throw out something, for example, empowerment. We think it's an important thing that women are empowered, but using that word and the connotations that go with it in a context like Afghanistan or others where power itself is so loaded, it's so, it connotes something that could be negative, especially when it comes to women. So we might be hurting ourselves when we have a women's empowerment program, when it really, the way that it's translated in many cases is women above men, which we don't want to have anybody think, because that's not what we're doing. So when we talk about the idea of gender justice, for example, that encompasses both men and women, and we talk about who would benefit from that, and it is both men and women, and in fact it's families. So if we talk about one of the programs we have is maternal health. And one of the approaches in that has been effective is to talk with men about the health of their communities and their families. And a natural component of that is the health of the mother. So it's a long way to get to the point, which is maternal health, but it makes so much more sense in this context. And it creates a much more sustainable conversation, and then that leads into more sustainable action for what we're talking about. So that to me is not just in Afghanistan, but overall, we need to be seriously concerned about what words we're using. And just looking at how in these tribal areas or in these even urban areas for that matter, but it's communal rights, and it's beyond an individual right. So whenever we talk about women's rights, sometimes it gets pushed into, well, that's just an individual right, which doesn't make sense in our context. So just gender sensitivity means including them both. And then also in terms of development programs, what we are looking at, I think, more seriously across the board is who is being included when we develop programs or understand, you know, the strategy for working with women. Who's being talked to? Who are we including at the table before we put everything together? And who's interfacing and engaging? Who's the face of the program is really essential for talking about development programs. Yes, the development indicators we can look at, and those are measurements, and those are numbers that are out there to guide us in our work. And we know that the situation of women in Afghanistan, especially in this context, is not good. But the step we need to take further is look at how are the communities themselves measuring the impact, or measuring their own, what indicators are they using themselves? Which is, again, a more complex, nuanced approach. But ultimately, when we go in and say, what's happening that's right, we might find out that even though the girls aren't going to school, there's a lot of education taking place. And so we're looking at that more informal sector as an approach and as part of the process. So instead of saying all these girls have to come to the school that may be under security threat, let's look at what's already happening in education that we can support, rather than just have them connect with what we have. And the bottom line for this, too, I think is really important in terms of development for women and girls, is we need more data. We need more information. We have not had enough people out there collecting it, not just for the work we do, but just in general. And I think that's something we're looking at seriously. Some of the work we've done, dipping into the networks that exist. So now we're looking at more women-led NGOs that are out there doing the work and saying that we can rely on them and work with them to get us the information that will help us have more meaningful programming. So that's an exciting trend, because then that interaction and that partnership helps us do our work better, but it also builds the capacity of these NGOs in the field to go out and do more work.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me, I mean, themes that I keep hearing from you are go slower, gather the data, get local knowledge, and some of the, and specifically these programs for women and girls, have been targeted as un-Islamic or un-Afghan. And one of the things I'm, attacks on girls' schools, for example, what I'm hearing you saying is, instead, let's see how people are working this out for themselves and how we can support those efforts and strengthen them, rather than build the big school that's a bus ride away, or it's dangerous to get there, but it also provides a nice target for radical elements to attack in a sort of symbolic way. So that's really a change direction, or a logical outcome of this new approach.
Right. I think just building on that is, when we look at targets, for example, girls' schools, yes, we can say, you know, it's coming from a religious or ideological place, but we can also say it's basic law and order. And the concern is there isn't law and order in place in where this is happening. So that correlation we sometimes glaze over, but that is an issue, of course. And what we're doing further, I think, is trying to create ownership of the programs and projects by the Afghan people themselves, which is going to be essential for any development work that is sustainable. And one way to do that, of course, is to engage further, like I said, with the existing NGOs, but even more with the tribal elders, with the community leaders, with the religious leaders that are there, and have them ask them, really, is this something that would make sense in your context? And once they feel that they are a part of the process, they will protect the schools or they will protect the projects, because it means something to them. But if it's something that's imposed, that somebody else decided that these five schools need to be built somewhere, which doesn't, like you were saying, doesn't make sense practically. It also doesn't make sense, culturally, to whatever extent. Then they won't take ownership of it. I mean, that's a basic correlation. Mm-hmm. So why would they worry or be concerned if it's not sustained? So these are the elements that we're working with, and we're trying to have a more nuanced approach. And, you know, you were mentioning going slow, and that's difficult to measure and to understand. So one of the things we're looking at is, you know, timing of projects and understanding it, but also thinking that there might be some short-term projects we could do with more impact as long as we have more engagement. Mm. So I think the key is engagement, and the key is really it's not, you know, the U.S. stamp on our projects, because that is also sometimes, as we know, the kiss of death, and we don't want to proliferate that. But it is that if the community recognizes the need and recognizes that they mm-hmm. have the resources, then they themselves will go further in keeping it going. Another piece that has been an issue for many development projects in the past, and not necessarily USAID, but just in general, has been, you know, we'll build, an outside agency will come and build a school or even a dam or any infrastructure, but then there's no maintenance. There's nothing that keeps it going. And so ownership, again, when it's not there, it erodes it, literally and figuratively. So you have a situation where it's not something that is useful to anybody. So what we're looking at, again, is beyond just the structure, and beyond that, what else? What are the other elements we need? And yes, we need to have a plan for maintenance. We need to have a plan for what's going to happen. What's a contingency plan for other things that, you know, could occur, and so on and so forth. So that's taking it slow, but it's also taking it comprehensively. And we're working with our, you know, colleagues in military, our colleagues in state, and other agencies to look at this more comprehensively so it makes mm-hmm. The greatest impact.
So it's not necessarily always a question of go or slow, more slowly. This changed perspective can actually help you move faster in some context depending on the outcome of the analysis. That's very, very interesting. A word that you use continuously as well, and I think is very important to highlight, is sustainable. And you're just talking about the sustainable dam or the sustainable school. And this fits with the administration's plans for Afghanistan are that local organizations and individuals will be taking over the development and the security work. And I think this is scheduled to be approximately 18 months from now, though I think there's uncertainty about that. It sounds to me that right now the kind of cultural development approach that you and others are bringing is really setting up that transition to work more smoothly. And I think that's a great thing for American people to know about, because people want their dollars to be spent wisely and they want the projects to benefit people long term. What obstacles are you currently seeing to that transition happening, obstacles to doing this work in ways that do create sustainability and momentum that people themselves are going to own the projects and take them forward?
Well, I don't know if it's so much obstacles as it is, you know, just general challenges in trying to meet the president's mandate, which I think all around is something that's positive. That is, let's get more civilians out there. And we are working very hard to meet that challenge and that mandate, because as development practitioners, we believe that is the best, having civilians out there that know what they're doing and are part of a larger core of effort, I think is in and of itself an important it's part of the design but also part of the implementation. And a couple of things that we're looking at is when we do the recruitment of civilians, for example, looking at, you know, at folks that have at the very least, you know, have the experience in being in a conflict situation. So it's not just anybody that knows development. They really have to have that experience to help, you know, shorten the time of orientation. We're also looking for language ability. We're looking for capabilities in areas that are most needed there. So even just the recruitment of civilians, it's a long process. It's a tedious process. But and I've sat in some of the interviews, is really the process is how can we get the best people out there who may not be there for very long because the deployments are generally shorter because of the conflict, but can have the most impact. So it's a thoughtful process. The challenge is to try to get those folks out there. So some of the ways that we've been doing that is really putting it out there with outreach. One of the specific groups that we've been communicating and targeting is the Afghan-American community here in the U.S. And we have a very robust outreach office with our Afghanistan-Pakistan task force that just does this type of engagement. We had a wonderful roundtable with Afghan-American NGOs and individuals a few months back where we brought them to our offices. They met with the task force head and talked about what they see as challenges, but also what they have been either engaged in or know of that is working in Afghanistan. And some of that was great to hear. It's been on our radar on different levels, but to hear it from them and to be able to engage them further on it was very helpful. So we've, you know, put out the appeal that these are the criteria, these are the things that we're looking for to deploy more civilians. Can you help us reach more people that will fit that? So this interaction and this dynamic of reaching out to people that we haven't before, organizations, it's ongoing. And I think that will help us to get more people out there that will have greater impact. So it's a part of the process. You know, can we just get all the boots on the ground, so to speak, or as we like to say, the Birkenstocks, because we're not boots, in time or whatever the time frame is? You know, that is the challenge. And I think, I mean, it's a great challenge because it means that we're putting serious consideration on what needs to be done, which is to get civilians out there. And it's really interesting, actually, because the people that are going out are the ones that I have conversation with some of the ones that we deploy who are so enthusiastic about learning everything they can about what they're going into, which is, again, to me, that's a great sign because they are going in, they already know that I can't go in cold. I need to understand what the context is. So, you know, great conversations on that. And there are some informal trainings that we do, you know, before we deploy them out on, okay, these are the structures that you're going to be dealing with. And they may not necessarily all of them engage on these levels, but for them to understand it and know it is really important beyond language skills. So that's the other piece of it, is the folks that we're putting out there, make sure that they have a grounding and to let them know they have support mechanisms in place. And it's an ongoing challenge, and we're very open to when getting feedback from people that are in the field saying, you know, we need more of this, or this is where we're lacking, and we're able to say, let's pull it together. You know, we have, for example, we've created resource lists of multimedia resources that people can tap into just so they have something on hand. Again, beyond the language, but also about the cultural competency and connecting people to people. So we have NGOs here that are doing good work in Afghanistan, Afghan-American NGOs, and connecting them to other work that's happening with our other implementing partners. So creating those connections as well, because some of these NGOs are too small to necessarily have the capacity to manage larger projects, but we want to build their capacity. So connecting them to a larger organization fulfills the connection we want to make with them, but also helps the larger organization have that capacity for understanding the local. So we're trying to also, as an agency, be the platform to create those connections and have people come together that we feel, from all this insight and observations, that would make the most impact.
Well, that's most informative. Now, Afghanistan could occupy you full time, but it doesn't because you have huge regions of the world to be concerned about. Can you give us some examples, some issue areas of culture and development? You mentioned young people in Mindanao. And while each has their own unique characteristic, what are some of the, you know, kind of common problems that you're running into? How are you either now addressing them or planning on addressing them?
I think a lot of what we've talked about in the Afghan context, we can extrapolate out too, because it is going back to the frame, and it's going back to approach. Mm-hmm. Yes, a lot of people would like to just have a toolkit that they can carry around, and you know, in that toolkit is how to understand culture, or you know, you pick out that one piece and you know how to do it. And the challenge is again to understand that cultural context and competency and all of that. It's not a body of knowledge. It's not a body of understanding do's and don'ts of a culture. It's far beyond that. So what we're hoping is to create in all of us the sense that, first of all, culture matters, and then what is it that why does it matter to what I'm doing? So those connections are really critical, because without this list of do's and don'ts, We can go in with our own frames and our own biases and our own understanding of, like we said earlier, how we live life. And going in and saying, well, we're going to program this as if we're in such and such other country is just not going to work. What many people have said would be great would be have an anthropologist at every office or mission for USAID. And I don't know if it's the anthropologist itself that we're... I mean, of course, I would go for that, but it's not so much just having an anthropologist, but it's streamlining this sense of importance for what we're talking about as far as what culture means, and understanding that whenever you work with a community, whether it's the community level or the national, whatever level you're working with, not understanding this context is not just not a nice thing, but ultimately it can be detrimental to everything we do. But it's a work in progress, in the sense that we don't want to just say, okay, here's your anthropologist, you better use this, you better use the anthropologist to do your work. We really want to shift the understanding of what we're doing. And, you know, one thought is that in the past we had many of our USAID staff and so on were former Peace Corps workers who had lived in countries and had been engaged and understood to some extent the value of culture. And now we have a trend where we have more and more folks that have degrees in international development and have master's degrees in program management and so on and so forth. So they're really great at managing programs, which is what we need. But they may be missing this link or this understanding of why culture matters. So trying to institutionalize it, not just as a nice thing again, but the fact that a program, you can't manage a program with all the tools you have for management if that program just won't fit where you're trying to put it. So that's the piece that we're working on. It's a general challenge, but again, what I'm excited about is that it's not, you know, just one person or two people that are interested in this. This really is all the way across the agency, up and down. And we have so much to already learn from that we've done, which is also another exciting piece of it. We have best practices in place across the work that we've done. It's just pulling those together and saying that, you know, we have resources, we have people, we have approaches, and here's how we're going to consolidate them and then create, if we have to, obviously training, which is great to do, but even more so institutionalizing it within so that it's, you know, culture is cross-sectoral, and so therefore when we do programming, culture will permeate through everything that we look at for programming as well.
Well, if it's difficult to get people to see culture, it is even more difficult to get them to see religion as a part of culture. And that's not just in Afghanistan. I mean, that's certainly everywhere. Recently, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs had a task force on religion and the making of U.S. foreign policy, and they issued a report, Engaging Religious Communities Abroad, a New and Imperative for U.S. Foreign Policy. And I know you were invited to comment on the report after it was published. What did you think of it, and what are some of the issues you think it raises, some of the things that you'd like to say about the recommendations?
It's a very, very helpful report all the way around, very sound recommendations in terms of types of engagement, the reasons for engagement with religious communities and leaders, and very specific recommendations for the U.S. government to follow through on. So we're very excited to see it and to know that it's out there. In many ways, it boosts what we're all trying to do within the agencies that we work in, USG. So that was actually exciting that we were able to say to the folks that put out the report, but also engage on the discussion that what you have recommended, we have been working on different levels. So, for example, this idea of engagement officers or having people in posts or missions that would, their job would just be to be, have engagement is a recommendation that they had made that we have been working on, you know, getting buy-in, but then getting an understanding of how could we actually operationalize it. So that piece is there. We have a religion and global affairs working group that was started 2 years ago, almost a year and a half, between USAID and State Department, where we get together on a regular basis to discuss some of these issues. And now that will be taken to another level as a larger interagency effort. So these are, again, efforts we've had in place. So what we're trying to do now with regard to how the report is making recommendations is consolidate and coordinate what we have been doing. There are issues and concerns that we need to be aware of, such as the Establishment Clause when it comes to religious engagement. And that has to be a thoughtful conversation. We can't just say, well, we can do it no matter what. We also have to understand how can we do it so that we do keep, we maintain that separation that is so important to us as a secular state and as a secular agency. As far as a report, again, you know, it has recommendations that are important, but it's exciting to say that these conversations are ongoing within our agencies. And again, with the president's mandate for greater engagement, religious leaders and communities are seen as, you know, just another group of people we need to engage with. And in the development context, what we really are seeing is that religious leaders in and of themselves are development practitioners. They're already doing development in their role as leaders of influence. They're already involved in conflict resolution, education, and other realms.
Delivery of services.
Exactly. Yeah. So why not engage with them on that? And which is what we do. We wouldn't engage with them as religious, on religious issues, obviously, but on the on their ability and capacity to deliver development to their communities. So, but it's not just to use them or interact with them when we have a project or a program, but before that as well. So they're on the table with the other community leaders that we have, discussing what are the needs and what is going on right. And as we said before, they're a part of that discussion from the beginning as development practitioners. So, you know, again, exciting times to have all of this coming from very different places, whether it's NGO communities or these advisory councils, mm-hmm. the councils that are making these recommendations, and then from the administration. So it's all coming to a head where the conversations are getting more nuanced, complex, but then there are deliverables out of those conversations as well. And so we're trying to create the space to have intellectual, academic understanding of the issues and then go forward with what do we do next as operational. But it, you know, it's a bureaucracy, so whatever we can get done, whatever little things we get done, we celebrate. But we know that, you know, underlying it all is the will, and that will is always, you know, you need to have that in place before you can have anything else. So, again, we're excited to have that all around.
Well, I really thought that the report's recommendation for further study on how does the Establishment Clause apply in foreign policy was a good recommendation. It was even a source of a minority report within the report. Is that something your working group is going to tackle, or do you know if there's going to be follow-up on that from any quarter?
Well, as far as the Establishment Clause goes, yes. I mean, we've been having smaller conversations as we go, but I think it will be very much something that we look at interagency-wide. And, you know, there are different levels of understanding of the Establishment Clause, which is really part of the issue. Is there assumptions being made? So we want to unravel that. And so what is it essentially? And then also how does it apply to, for example, development work as opposed to public diplomacy, as opposed to, you know, the other pieces we do?
Because it's not one piece of cloth.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, you know, and even the definitions. What does it mean to engage religious leaders? Is engagement different than, you know, signing a contract for doing a project where funds get transferred? So obviously there are different ways to define engagement, but these are things we need to we now have the space, I think, to really delve into and have a more thoughtful understanding after a thoughtful conversation. So I think it's a good time.
Thank you very much for taking the time to go into more depth on these issues. I really appreciate it, and I look forward to ever more products out of your innovative work. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It was my pleasure.